Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Today's episode is titled Refugees Remaking Cities, and I am delighted to be joined by Professor Manoj Ray, who is professor at the School of Liberal Studies, University of Petroleum and Energy Studies, UPES, Dehradun. Formerly, he was a professor of cultural studies at the Center for Studies in Social Sciences, Calcutta. As the coordinator of the cultural studies workshop hosted by the Center for Studies in Social Sciences, Calcutta, for the largest part of its life of 20 years, he has played a key role in the spread and dissemination of cultural studies in India and in the Global South. His earlier memoir, published in History Workshop Journal, titled Growing Up Refugee, has been widely cited and republished. Among his recent publications are also two edited books on contemporary Indian democracy, published towards the end of 2021. These are titled Crisis of Liberal Deliberation, Facets of Indian Democracy and the State of Democracy in India, Essays on Life and Politics in Contemporary Times. Thank you so much, Manoj, for joining us today.
Thank you also, Romola, for inviting me.
I'm really excited to have you on this podcast. I would like to begin with a brief background of your family's journey to Calcutta as refugees and your own experience of growing up as a refugee in that refugee area and what that means as well.
Well, it's a good time to have this talk because I got the kind of sequel to the first one, Growing Up Refugee, published recently in the same journal, History Workshop Journal. It's titled The Volatile 70s and talks about Naxalbari violence as well as Bangladesh war. Now, to answer about, your question on my background and particularly my family's journey to Calcutta as refugees, I must confess I was born in 1954, that is 7 years after the partition. My family had two houses in Dhaka, in East Bengal. Incidentally, Dhaka was the second largest city after Calcutta in undivided Bengal and now the capital of Bangladesh. Our house was in the village. That was one house and which we owned it. But for all practical purposes, my folks lived in the city, in a rented place, in an old district called Gandaria, a majorly Hindu locality. The house was at the beginning of a lane. One evening, soon after the partition, the house was set on fire. My mother rushed out with her three children, one being a baby. She ran towards the end of the lane because that's where her parents lived. My father, a school headmaster, joined the family there in the evening after being chased, actually, with iron rods on his way back from the school. Now, within a day or two, both the families left for independent India. And I must mention this here, that they were escorted by no less than 100 students of my father, and who were all Muslims. When the train reached the station, they found that all the windows and doors were locked from inside. One brave chap wrapped his hand with a towel and gave a hefty blow that caused a hole. Then he tore the hole larger, and another chap squeezed his body inside and opened the door. They were both bleeding after the operation. I'm told that it was a miserable journey all through. The families landed up in one of my maternal uncle's railway quarter in Kancherapada, which you'd know is about 50 kilometers from Calcutta in the north. There were two rooms and one long veranda. At night, mattresses were spread wherever there was any space. I have been told that it was a chock-a-block scenario, bodies next to bodies. My own family moved to central Calcutta within a few weeks, where my father was trying to set up a school. He was a school headmaster in undivided East Bengal. He and one of his aunts rented a tenement quarter in a damp and crowded area of central Calcutta. Their neighbors were mostly native Calcuttans, what we in Bangla call ghotis, with huge cultural and other sorts of differences causing occasional frictions. Finally, in the early 1950s, they moved to a squatter colony, Netaji Nagar, in the southern outskirts of the city. So it was a fallow land, mostly marshy patches with wild growths and ditches crisscrossing. The place was full of snakes, jackals, and insects of all varieties. My mother just refused to live there with her children. So the family continued to live in the rented place. By then, my grandmother had joined the family, leaving behind our village home. She started living at Netaji Nagar with her female help, who accompanied her from Dhaka. A colony committee was formed under the leadership of a handful of men, of some reputation actually, mostly teachers and lawyers. The colony committee demanded two things from each resident there, from each family rather: a monthly subscription of 1 rupee and a regularly used oven in the house. The upper caste and usually literate family got the higher lands, while the low-lying lands were distributed among the so-called lower castes, mostly working class people. Of top priority was setting up a school for boys and another for girls, because these schools, it was thought, would give the squatter colony the moral sanction it badly needed. The government at once lauded such enterprising spirit and also actively opposed the initiative, because these lands belong either to the government or to private owners, and in our case, to a bunch of owners whose claims to ownership was vague. By the time I was about 5 or 6 and started going out of the house, brick-laid roads had started coming up. The landscape changed drastically. The trees planted were mostly the trees that the refugees were acquainted with, and our squatter colony, like the adjoining ones, looked almost a replica of East Bengal villages. Mostly bamboo-thatched rooms, with burnt earthen tiles or tin roof and a fairly spacious courtyard. Today, after all these years of drum roll, the refugees present a vastly variegated scenario, as you know, from top officials and professionals to tiny shop owners or emaciated vendors at busy market squares. So this is, in short, you know, the entire journey. Yeah.
I know that you have an excerpt from your piece, Growing Up Refugee, that I think we would love to listen to. Would you be able to share that piece with us?
I think you referred to the thief bashing thing, isn't it? Childhood was a time of peeping. Peeping and all kinds of fools. Peeping between the legs of my granny as she snored in her afternoon siesta. Peeping at the pickle jar through the rusty, torn iron net of the kitchen cupboard. Or peeping out through the hole under the bamboo fence of a primary school at the world turned upside down. We would occasionally slip out through that hole, run as fast as our legs could carry us. The next day at school was a long 24 hours away. There was another kind of holes, those made by thieves to enter into the house through the clay base of the walls. In Bengali, the act is called Shidkata, but for a long time I knew it as Shinkata, that is to dig hole with horns, and conjured up grotesque images of thieves as men with horns. Those events were indeed grotesque in what followed it, if the thieves were caught, which very often was the case. Thief bashing was a system all of its own, merciless night long. The initial alarms, the rushing of local men from different directions, the way they could cordon off the thieves, the early interrogations, tentative cuffs, the slow start of bashing, and the gagging of men with pieces of cloth when the elders left them to the care of the local youth, the carnival of brutality where everybody must have his turn. The fiesta ended in the ceremony of handing over the men to the cops and their officious boss early in the morning. By when the bodies of the victims drooped, a few teeth were missing, a damaged eyeball stirred from the depth of the socket. But often they remained magically with unimpaired faculty of speech, which broke into a howl the moment the police were spotted. "Sir, look what they have done to me." Mostly they would die before the cops came or on the way to the police station. Those who survived would at times be seen back on the job a few months later. After the police van left, the place wore a forlorn look. A few torn pieces of raiment, a couple of broken incisors or molars, and the inevitable blood stains. Someone among the revelers might then be looking for a missing slipper. Suddenly, someone might realize he's still grasping a tuft of hair in his closed fist, brush off the hair, and scurry homeward in revulsion. I would develop a ghastly intoxication for the spot where the bashing took place, usually at some intersection of lanes. I would go back to it several times in the next couple of days, but return inevitably with a slimy, salted taste in my mouth. I could not understand what made these men risk their lives and, crucially, the torture. All for a few blankets, those events would occur mostly in winter, talcum powder, a few saris, trousers, shirts, a transistor set maybe, and if in luck, a few gold trinkets. I could not understand why in the story that would be spun next day, the victims did not have a place, only direction, from the other side of the silted gutter or from the paddy fields way beyond our locality, someone would say vaguely. I could not understand why women and elderly who lamented to my mother, "It's too ghastly for the eyes, Didi," also and inevitably urged the youth to teach the men a good lesson next time. I could not understand why the man who plunged into our local pool to save a drowning child and then jumping on a wayside rickshaw, rode to the local hospital, ignoring the blistering afternoon heat would also champion such monstrosity. The valiant expression of our insecurity was never seriously challenged. The collective brutality of the community was beyond the pale of its Marxist wisdom. Dhanesda could recognize one of the nocturnal visitors among the plumbers who had come to install a tube well in his house. "Well, have you given up? How can a human possibly teach you a lesson?" Not far away, his youthful wife might be busy pouring boiling water from the cooked rice.
Thank you so much for that. It was such an exciting reading. I wanted to ask about the relationship between the refugee colonies and the city. If you could reflect on your own experience to talk about how refugees changed the city of Calcutta, both in its built form and politically, but also what was that relationship between the refugee colonies and the city of Calcutta before the colonies were incorporated into the administrative boundaries of the city?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. See, one has to remember the refugee flow started from, say, the time of partition, that is 1947, and went unabated till at least the mid-1980s, you know? And there was a big influx in 1971 during the Bangladesh War. So initially, the refugee quarters were, you know, around Calcutta, just outside Calcutta, be it in the north, be it in the south. But now refugee colonies dot everywhere in West Bengal, almost all the districts. But let's concentrate on that particular squatter colony where I was born and where I spent the first 23 years of my life, Netaji Nagar. No? And that could be a microcosm of the larger scenario of post-partition Calcutta. So mostly people came from different districts, each with its own dialect. We spoke three languages, as it were. Our district dialect at home, a mixed dialect with Dhaka dialect having a clear hegemony in the locality, and the recognized Calcutta dialect for those who went to the city for work. The main road, among other things, signified a different language. The road that took us to a world of a different language, where our vernacular was a taboo. Some men, of course, couldn't care less, even in the public domain. But for women office goers, speaking the standard Calcutta dialect had a special meaning. It meant that they came from honorable families, you know, which was important for their space in the world of men. The landscape of the colony, after remaining more or less intact for nearly three decades, but once the inhabitants, you know, were given formal recognition of ownership from the government, it started changing. But the scenario would change drastically, dramatically in 1999 onwards, when land became sellable. Now, at long last, land actually became a private property for the refugees. Okay? So the real estate developers moved in, and almost overnight, three or four-storied apartment houses were built up, with the owner getting one or two flats, depending on it, I mean, on the size of the land. As people from other parts of the city or even outside the state started purchasing these apartments, the original inhabitants lost, among other things, their demographic hold over the place. given the ambiguity of government in the early years of the partition, the left could mobilize the refugees to come under the banner of their party. I mean, Netaji Nagar was the citadel of Communist Party of India, Marxist, as you know, the party that ran the government uninterrupted from 1977 to 2011. They dominated the colony committee, but now it is the case that, you know, the committee has become nothing better than a tutelary figure rather than an active agency. From being a locality at the outskirts of city Calcutta, Netaji Nagar has become very much a part of the main city itself. This became more prominent with the metro train reaching Netaji Nagar and other surrounding squatter colonies.
Do you want to tell the audience what the land and the property setup was before you were allowed to sell the land?
Yeah, I should have mentioned that. Thank you, Ramula. See, till about 1988, the refugees had no formal claim over the land, okay? Towards the end of 88, the government recognized them as, you know, like the real inhabitants of the plots that they were given, and that they couldn't be removed from there. The lease question came in 1999, and in Calcutta, as you know, no one can buy a piece of land forever. It's a 99 years lease. So the inhabitants of those plots, you know, became at par with other people who buy land in other parts of Calcutta, and which also means that now for the first time, they could sell their land, you know, other people could buy up those lands.
So on that point, one of the things that I also wanted to ask was about the political changes that the refugees brought to Calcutta. So again, I was wondering if you want to tell the audience a little bit about how the refugees also transformed the city politically through their activities and why.
Yeah, one has to move from my earlier article, Growing Up Refugee, to the one that I brought out recently, The Volatile 70s. You see, it is true that this refugee colonies were politicized very early. And as I mentioned, I think, the left party, the Communist Party, took advantage of this dilly-dallying of the government in the 50s. The large-scale frustration amongst the refugees. And so these refugee colonies usually, not all, but usually were like left-oriented places, you know, in politically, culturally, you know, the place that they used to stage, the songs they used to sing. So that was there. But the change actually, the big change rather, actually happened in the late 60s, early 70s, you know. And as you know, there is a Maoist movement, you know, called Naxalbari movement, which erupted in the late 60s at the foothills of the Himalayas in North Bengal, in a place, in a block rather, administrative block, called Naxalbari, okay? Which was sort of a Maoist, it soon became a Maoist stronghold under the leadership of the charismatic Charu Majumdar, who thought that annihilation of class enemies would be a spontaneous celebration of the exploited, a revolutionary festivity, you know, and spread like wildfire. But it actually, in reality, it didn't happen like that, because Indian reality is very complex, you know. A peasant is a class, but a peasant also has a caste, a region, a religion, you know. So it's a very, very amorphous kind of identity. But coming to your question, this Maoist movement affected the political texture of Calcutta and its surroundings in a very deep way. There was a violent urban uprising from the late 60s to, say, 72, 73, when the state actually went for a brutal crackdown of the movement. Now, you see, again, here it's multi-layered. There were students of Presidency College, which undoubtedly was then India's best undergrad institution, and the different engineering and medical colleges who took part in that revolutionary uprising. But by and large, it was the refugee, unemployed or poorly employed youth who became active. If that is true for the colonies, it's also true for those poor refugees who used to live in tenement houses in central Calcutta or north Calcutta and other such places. But the movement died out for many reasons, because of the severe kind of crackdown of the state. But then also, you know, in terms of what it actually resulted in. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, people found that these activists, be it in the villages or in the cities, you know, all that they managed to do was to kill big farmers and moneylenders. And in the city, a number of poor police constables. So it fizzled out. But the trait it, you know, left is, and that, you know, violence became part and parcel of Bengal politics right from that time.
So you've mentioned why people joined the movement from the refugee areas, but I want to also ask you what impact the Naxalite movement had on the refugee areas.
When it was ongoing, it did have an enormous effect. You know, in refugee colonies, you know, political killings became very common. Either, you know, between the rival groups or by the police. Okay. But once it faded out, the traces left behind were not very deep.
So you mentioned the links between the Naxalite movement in Calcutta and West Bengal and the independence struggle in Bangladesh, as well as sort of wider geopolitical movements in the 70s. So I was wondering if you wanted to elaborate on that.
Well, I mean, you see the Hindus from East Bengal, or Bengali Hindus in general, the story they propagate is just half of what is true. You know, the kind of nostalgia of a hegemonic, you know, community, at the same time a harmonious kind of living between Hindus and Muslims. You know, and that lush green meadows of East Bengal and all that, land of plenty. is a nostalgia. What the Bengali Hindus, the upper caste, I mean, and all of whom had some land holding, practiced with the Bengali Muslim peasants was, you know, nothing less than apartheid, but apartheid with a small a, I'll say. So you can make out that for Bengali Muslims, the partition of 1947 was only half the victory. The other half would be enacted in East Pakistan and result in the liberation of Bangladesh from the clutches of West Pakistani Urdu-speaking ruling class in 1971. So the struggle for self-esteem of the Bengali Muslims, you know, would get completed only after 1971. And 1947 and 1971, I think, form part of the same conjoined processes of the historical search for self-esteem. But what I have tried to establish in my recent article, The Volatile 70s, is that the Naxalbari uprising in Calcutta and surroundings, you know, has some historical links with the Bangladesh war. If you see them, you know, on a long process of history, during the uprising, Naxalbari uprising, traditions were questioned. The bourgeoisie landlord rule challenged. The continuation of the colonial legacy attacked, and the prevailing cultural, ethical, and sexual modes were put under intense scrutiny. No? So in that article, what I have tried to do, that as a young man in his late teens and early 20s, I tried to show how the streams of events in Bangladesh and the Indian state of West Bengal had remarkable convergences. They were not merely concurrent processes, but shared larger historical truths. And I'll go on in this article to ask myself, what is so unique about the early 70s? You know, why is there almost like a kind of geological explosion everywhere?
So finally, Manish, I wanted to just ask you, what are you planning on writing on next?
Next year, I plan to do a third part of my autobiography, this time dealing with the afterlife of Naxalbari urban uprising in Calcutta, something that you were interested in. The reality of sons and at times daughters being tortured and kept behind the bars indefinitely. They are coming out after 5 or 6 years to find their families shattered, and also having to cope with the realization that what they were pursuing all along was nothing better than a juvenile fantasy. As you know, I do not write history, you know, which is of facts and figures. I do not write memoirs, which is devoid of the social, the historical. I always try to blend the two up. And therefore, next year, I'm going to take interviews of those who spent a big chunk of their lives in the jail. It was a trying time all around, and I want to leave behind a record of it.
That sounds amazing, Manushla. Thank you so much. I wish you all the best with that project, and I can't wait to read it. Thank you so much for such an exciting talk today. I really appreciate it, and I know that all the listeners will be enjoying this as well. So thank you so much for joining us today.
And on my part, I thank the audience for all the patience they have shown. And I particularly thank Romola, my good friend, Romola Shannal, for inviting me to this special location. Thank you.